right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. As it is every week and every time that music comes on, if you hear somebody else come on and say, they're me, they're not, all right? I'm Michael Slate. Ha! Anyway, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with journalist author Larry Everest about his new piece, and you can find this in Revolution Newspaper and on revcom.us. And the piece is Netanyahu Bites, Obama Snarls Back, When Bloody-Jawed Wolves Feud, Don't Choose Sides. And before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And Carl was recently down in Selma, Alabama for the 50th anniversary of the 1965 brutal police and KKK attack on black people for seeking the right to vote. But first, opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Gabriel London. Gabriel's a director, producer, and cinematographer for the better part of a decade. He's been making documentary films, many of which deal with political issues from climate change to prison conditions in the U.S. His past works include Youth Authority California. I know a lot of people were familiar with that one. And No Escape, Prison Rape. But on the show today, we're going to be talking with Gabriel about his new film, The Mind of Mark DeFriest. And to set this up, we're going to take a listen to the trailer for that film. So here it is.
Did I tell you about that escape? It was a classic.
I don't know, we got half of them got hung up on the fence and the razor wires. They're screaming, DeFriest, wait up for me! I'm like, what the f*** is wrong with you people, man?
He became Houdini if he could escape.
You could make a piece of paper and make a key out of it.
Can you imagine what that brain could have done?
He's a little crazy, a little bit manipulative.
The presumptive parole release date.
It's 2082.
The Florida Department of Corrections took a low-level, non-violent prisoner and turned him into what Mark DeFriest became. He was in the worst wing.
Lived in total darkness in a small cell.
No electricity. His water had been cut off.
The amount of time this man received is ridiculous compared to most people in the state prison system.
He has some mental problems that he never should have been incarcerated.
They thought you were crazy.
Yeah.
Why?
I have no idea. Do I seem crazy?
Mark DeFriest's entire history should be examined.
I'm gonna just say this, I think I was wrong.
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer for the film, The Mind of Mark DeFriest, a brand new film by director Gabriel London. And you can catch this film on Showtime on March 19th and on Showtime On Demand anytime from March 20th through May 14th. Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Sure. Very moving film that I watched the other night. Powerful film that is just, I'm telling you, it's just stunning, folks. And I'm going to leave it to Gabriel to tell you what this is about.
For sure. So The Mind of Mark DeFriest is a film about a brilliant escape artist, a guy who's been in prison for 34 years, who went to prison for basically a dispute with his stepmother over his father's will. So it's a kind of alarming case where you look at it and you go, oh my God, the guy's been in prison for 34 years. Well, what did he exactly do? He became a great escape artist after he was put in prison in 1979. The issue was that his father had passed away and willed him tools that they had worked on together in a shared business. They were very skilled mechanics. Mark was known from the time he was a kid as being a savant, as being a kind of beautiful mind for mechanics. And he ended up taking these tools from his stepmother's shed before the will had probated and without her permission. And as a result, she called the cops. When the cops showed up, he ran. And this is really a big question in Mark's whole history, is how culpable he is for his own actions with authority. He's a very brilliant person from a mechanical perspective, again, but he has always lacked a real awareness of how to interact with other individuals. He's funny, but he never knows when to stop saying the same joke. So anyway, I began developing this film 13 years ago thinking maybe I had a feature film, something that could be, you know, a Hollywood film. But as I researched, I started to uncover evidence of what basically you could consider an incarceration gone awry. You know, like this is a guy that went to prison for something so minor, he ended up in there for so long. And there were always these dogged questions as to whether he was competent, you know, mentally competent. Literally, there were psychiatrists who said, four out of five of them who said he was incompetent to stand trial and to be sentenced. And then ultimately there was one doctor in the records that I found, a guy named Dr. Berland, who said he was faking mental illness. And as a result of him, Mark was allowed to plead guilty. He never had a jury trial to what amounted to a life sentence. And he's been in prison ever since. And, you know, basically the film chronicles both his Houdini history and then a modern effort, in fact, led by that very doctor, to potentially get him out on parole. So there's both a verite story and an animated backstory that really brings people into Mark's life.
Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, folks, it's a really compelling film. I put it on and I wasn't really sure what I was going to watch, what I was going to see. And I was just glued to the screen. I couldn't leave it. And it outrages you. You begin to know people in a different concept. It actually, you know, forces you to think about things in a way that you wouldn't normally view them. And it just presents a story that, while you know in general happens, you know, and you have some idea in general that it happens, you've made this guy, Mark DeVriest, very, very compelling as a human being. And I want to, again, remind people that we're talking with director Gabriel London. We're talking about his film, The Mind of Mark DeVriest. This film is something that people have to see. Now, you talked about this in your director statement. You talked about this coming upon Mark's story, that when you started to hint at this, but this was something not just that you found as interesting or sort of like, wow, this is sort of out of the box. You actually felt really compelled to tell the story, because it took a lot, I think, to actually get in there and tell this story.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't looking to be like a bleeding heart about, you know, oh man, this guy never should have gone to prison. I was just sort of looking at issues of prison rights. You know, I was looking at conditions of confinement at the time. I was researching a film for Human Rights Watch on the issue of prison rape. So I was very much informed on the fact that there were a lot of abuses going on in U.S. prisons. But it wasn't like every prisoner that was in contact with me, I was jumping at the chance to tell their story. And I'd say that just because, you know, there was something very fresh about Mark, in the sense that he had this sort of matter-of-fact, very present tense way of telling his own story, and yet I knew there was this incredible backstory because I'd read about him in articles, and in particular one article that described X-Wing, which was the super solitary wing that he lived on in Florida State Prison, which were the two floors above the electric chair. And he was the only nonviolent prisoner, only person who had never, quote, physically harmed another individual held there. So he was with the worst of the worst, but he was really just the biggest troublemaker. He was the guy that was just the needle in the eye of the cops, who just couldn't quite program and get with it. And I think part of that was that Mark had no understanding that there was the possibility that he would ever get out. So he was playing every day as if it might be his last, and he was trying to keep a kind of moral stand. You know, he never joined gangs. You know, he always was this kind of lone survivor type, and he was on a mission to just make it through every day and make it as fun as possible. So he was the guy that was able to invent a radio, you know, basically take the Walkman that the guys on death row were allowed to have, and when they would be executed, literally a porter would drop off the Walkman on his food slot, and he would have to go to work within a course of a couple of hours before the guards came by to take a full-size Walkman and reduce it to something that he could fit literally inside his body. And, you know, Mark, you know, just a gifted mind, a really fascinating individual, and I always looked at the story like, man, this is just a great story that has to be told. And then it was as I was doing the research and I was literally going through these files that I was like, oh my Lord, you know, this is somebody who, there were a lot of professional opinions that tried to keep this guy out of prison, and yet somehow the prison system just ate him up. You know, the prison system, once he was in the prison system, it wasn't like people were like, oh, Mark, do you need some medical care? Do you need some mental health advice? Do you want some medication? You know, oh, can we try and program you out of this? No, they were like, you are a bad apple, and we're going to break you. And they kept at it for, you know, 34 years or 30 years. I mean, the time that he spent, particularly in Florida State Prison, was a time of, you know, let's try and break Mark DeVriest. Let's try and keep him from going to the yard for as long as we can. I ended up getting documentary evidence in his case, his entire case file, that included all of his disciplinary reports, which were alarming to me because they weren't for shanking guards, they weren't for attacking other inmates, they were for saying his name wrong at count, for calling himself James Bond. And this is a guy that didn't have like a real grasp, so I felt like, maybe there's something here that if I put it in front of an audience, they might sort of feel like maybe something went off here, something went off in the wrong direction. And in fact, you know, when I even went through the grievances that he filed, I was able to substantiate the fact that he was not allowed to go to the yard, not even for 1 hour a week, from his windowless cell for over a decade. And I just thought, man, you know, this is the kind of stuff that audiences are going to see, and they're going to get a real insight into Mark, but they're also going to get a real depth charge that takes them into the prison world that we've heard so much about, but we haven't really seen in sort of intimate detail. And that was what those letters and those records and everything allowed us to do with the story. I just think it's a layer of depth that, you know, for the prison system, you don't see that often.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing I have to say that really got me is that an element of Mark is that he refused to give up especially his conviction that he shouldn't be where he is. And he's, yeah. You know, as you say, he's been there 34 years, 27 in solitary. You know, this is like, you know, I mean, you know, you're looking at Albert Woodfox, who's been in solitary the longest in the country, but he's not that far ahead of where Mark has been. You know, and you look at this thing at 27 years in solitary, and some of that in absolute darkness, with nothing, not even a shred of clothing. I mean, this is like you're looking at this, and it's sort of at the same time in all of this hitting him, he refuses to give up his conviction that he shouldn't be where he is. And that it was unjust that he got a 4-year sentence in the first place, and it was unjust that he end up doing life.
Yes. You know what? I mean, Mark maintains this sort of I'm a stranger in a strange land philosophy. And what that means is that he never basically became what they said he was. You know, he maintained that he was different from the environment that he was in, that he was not, you know, a true criminal, that he wouldn't succumb to the, you know, the invitation to violence that was put in front of him. And in many ways, I hope that people perceive, in a sense, the choice that he made, because it's not a perfectly clear choice. You have to understand that it's the absence of a choice. You know, it's the decision not to become something that makes, you know, him kind of remarkable in a way. There's a countervailing narrative that exists, you know, in a movies like Un Prophète, you know, or, you know, where you're seeing like somebody who goes into the prison system as a lowly criminal and then becomes some sort of a mastermind kingpin. That's not Mark DeVries. Now, I would say that he did find ways of having contraband, of, you know, surviving, of putting a needle in the eye of his captors. But he was doing it in the service of what I think he considered a moral narrative. And I think it's up to the audience to really decide whether they think that was a correct choice or whether he was really just a prisoner of his own making, as the parole commissioner has said about him, one of the parole commissioners. And I think, you know, that's the tension of the movie. And I think, like, Mark is not a perfect victim. I think we should be at pains to sort of tell the audience here that it's not, this isn't a story about somebody who was literally innocent. And that's what I liked about it. I liked that gray area. I liked this idea that this is a guy that you never had a jury of his own peers. And then, in fact, by telling his story, the audience would be the jury that he never had. And I think, you know, like, that feeling and that tension is what drives the film and sort of makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with director Gabriel London about his film, The Mind of Mark DeVries. And it's a very powerful film that should not be missed. And you can catch the film on Showtime on March 19th and on Showtime Demand anytime between March 20th and May 14th. Now, Gabriel, one of the things that about Mark that you talk about in a couple of places, and I thought it would be interesting to just dig into a little, is that you were, and you've mentioned this a number of times now, you were dealing with a guy who at the early age of 19, I mean, think about this, 19 years old, you know, you got a lot of bravado, but you don't have a whole hell of a lot of understanding of you know, the bigger thing out there, especially when you're growing up in a kind of atmosphere and the surroundings that Mark grew up in. And he's been buried in the deepest recesses of some of the worst prisons imaginable. Mm. And you had to pull a story together. I imagine problems of access and all kinds of other things really plagued you in terms of trying to pull this together, because how do you even get to interview a guy like that?
Yeah. I mean, you raise a really interesting point in the sense, well, what are the things that open doors, right? I mean, what are the things that allow for transparency to take place and then for people to shine lights inside on a system? And it was what seemed like an insurmountable task when I first found the story. Mark was actually, if you can believe it, because this is a California show, he was actually incarcerated at Pelican Bay up in Crescent City, California. And that's because Mark is on Interstate Compact, which is something that is a kind of an arcane thing that trades prisoners throughout the different state systems. And at the time, and I don't know if it still continues, I don't live in California anymore, but I did at the time, anybody who was in the press, there was a total media blackout, which I don't know, that only serves you know, to shield people inside the system from any kind of oversight, which, you know, I think is just incredible that it ever existed and that it was ever seen as a good policy. And in fact, it was Gray Davis's policy. You know, it was a Democratic governor who actually put that in effect. So it kind of gave lie to any sense at that time that there was a, you know, a partisan divide on how to treat people, particularly at that level of government. And what's happened in the time since then is that, you know, Mark has been transferred to other prisons. We have different policies. I was able to start recording phone conversations. Then I was able to start going back and actually find people who knew him. So I started to go, maybe this isn't just a dead history. Maybe this is something that's going to come to life. You know, I always kind of held out that possibility that, that the film itself would catalyze something or something in the filmmaking process would actually catalyze something that we could film. And in fact, that really started to change. And I would say that access really begins with truth-telling, you know, the willingness to tell truth. You know what I mean? It's the willingness to let somebody in. And when I met Dr. Berland, who figured is really the nemesis for Mark in the early years, you know, he was the guy that said he was faking mental illness and paved the way for the long sentences that Mark was serving. Well, I found him, got him on the phone in 2008, told him I was making a film about Mark DeVries, and he basically told me right off the bat, if Mark DeVries is still in prison, then I must have made a mistake. And it's like when a bigger figure, when somebody who's older, who's of a generation that you know, is really looking back on its actions and is able to actually say I was wrong, I think that's the exception to the rule, and it's the beginning of access. It's the beginning of truth, and that's what happened. You know, like when he said that, he really opened the door. He opened the door for the story. The actual prison door, if you will, opened very, very slowly. I ended up going in with him to do the first psychological interview he'd done on Mark in 28 years to revisit his past, in a sense, see if he could correct his own record and find a diagnosis. And that was my first opening to film with Mark. And it was pretty amazing. He came blinking out of solitary confinement. He was just shocked to see us. And, you know, you have to see the film to really get a sense of this, but he was wall-eyed. You know, he had not been out of his cell, and he had made a vow of silence for 2 weeks before he came out. But then, ultimately, I was able to get in because, literally, I made a relationship with one of the wardens in the prison system where he is now, actually stopped me filming. I was filming Mark's wife coming out one day with some prison crafts that he'd made, and I thought, man, like, let me just get this shot. I didn't have permission to film on grounds that day, but I was accompanying Bonnie to visit Mark, and I was stopped at the gate. They said, were you filming back there? And I said, yeah, I'm really sorry about that. I was just getting this one shot. I wasn't, all right, well, you just pull over here. The warden's going to come out and talk to you. And literally, that warden could have wiped my whole memory card and said, don't ever come back here. And you know what he said to me instead? I was telling him as he was going through my clips, I'm making this movie about Mark DeVries. He's been in prison. He's doing a lot better in your prison, you know. And he was hearing the whole story of Mark and goes, why don't you just apply to film with him? I said, I tried. You know, it wasn't so easy. They said I was out of state. It wasn't possible. I got a big no. And he said, well, you just send a letter to me. And I sent him the letter. And 2 weeks later, I was in that prison filming Mark, and that is the main interview that carries the film. So it comes down to individuals being willing to open doors, I believe, and that's what made all the difference.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with director Gabriel London about his film, The Mind of Mark DeVries, and it's a very powerful film that should not be missed. And you can catch the film on Showtime on March 19th and on Showtime Demand anytime between March 20th and May 14th. Now let's talk about the other aspect of the film that's really compelling and beautiful too, which is the animation. That seemed to be a product of, sort of related to what we've just been talking about, it seems to be a product though of the sort of marriage of creativity and necessity in this situation.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, you know, I knew I wasn't going to get a Hollywood budget for my unknown documentary subject to do all his escapes. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I would have loved to have had like a stuntman jump out of a third story window and steal a tractor trailer, but that just wasn't going to happen. So, but the other thing that was kind of an organic, if you will, decision about this was just like, you know, I knew I wanted to bring back to life some of the kind of incredible escapes that I'd found in the records and in the newspaper articles. And heard from Mark, but I, you know, not having a real option on recreations, I thought about animation, and this was back in 2007, and you know, it was before the Waltz with Bashir, and it was before the Chicago 10, and you know, it predated a lot of the animated docs that have come since. So I don't want to be seen as a late arrival on that scene, you know what I'm saying? But the other piece of this is just that Mark became a great illustrator in prison. I mean, people who see the film will see that this guy took his mechanical mind and used it to become a creative mind in prison. And he did a lot of cartoons where he sort of cast himself in some of the roles and did, you know, little captions that are pretty funny, made 3D cards. And he's gone on to do a lot of other creative elements and furniture building with popsicle sticks and, you know, that kind of thing. But it sort of said to me, you have license to then potentially look at illustration as a way to bring back his story, because he's already sort of started to illustrate his own story. But the other piece of it was, I always felt like Mark kind of had a great comic book narrative. You know what I'm saying? Like the death of the father, tragic, the incredible gift that was also a curse. And so it felt like we could do like comic book style animations that in a way would do justice to the medium and also do justice to the story. And so that's what we did. We worked with a company in Toronto called Thought Cafe that did an amazing amount of work for this and did a beautiful job of both creating the escapes but also creating the cell where Mark was. And then we project into the cell a lot of the actual documentation. I always wanted people to understand that I was corroborating the story, that it wasn't like just Mark's word against the guards. There is so much evidence in this film, and animation also gave us that ability to sort of infuse the scene with the actual dialogue from the reports and from the interviews and the court transcripts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it really is. It's a very powerful method to use there. I mean, I was really, really, again, that was really impressive. And particularly when I found out this, the role that Mark played in actually helping to create some of this stuff, you know, just by example or whatever, by his work. We're running up on our time, but I wanted to ask you a couple things. Where do things stand now with Mark? And I'm kind of thinking both in terms of how has he changed from that moment he first came blinking out of darkness in solitary to today, and then where do things stand with his case?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mark has really had his life changed by having the attention of me as a storyteller on him. And what I mean by that is I think you see it in psychological studies on kids that are growing up at risk. You know, if there's one person in the life that's just saying, how'd you do on your report card? And I'm like that guy to Mark. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm just like the guy that's like telling his story, coming back day after day and actually, you know, kind of on his case or in his case, you know? And I think that catalyzed something. And I think in particular, though, what you see in the film, and I don't know, I'm sort of reluctant. I mean, people can look up some of the things that have happened in the case. We've catalyzed a lot. I don't really want to give away the film, but I would say that people who go into this will see that the actual act of storytelling, but then the actual act of the audience after the story was told originally, has an incredible effect. So it's both, you know, the single sort of director's approach to choose the story that sort of pushes something along in Mark. But then there were a lot of people that joined. You know, there were a lot of people that sort of just through the filmmaking process, like Dr. Berlin, joined in. And, you know, it's an exciting thing. I mean, a lot has changed in the years that since I started making it. And, you know, I kind of want to mention also on this call, because I got the news while I was on the call, that when I started really in earnest making the documentary in 2007, I had the privilege of sitting, you know, right upstairs from Albert Maysles, who just passed away today. And, you know, I think what's important to realize is that, you know, there's a finite amount of time everybody has on Earth. And, you know, I just felt like if I could just move this story through, if I could get enough people to believe in it, and Albert was an early believer, but there were others, so many, that sort of mentored this project and brought it forward, that maybe collectively we could tell the story. So yes, it did start with my decision to make this film and to actually shine a light on Mark DeVries, but it really carries forward to the community that we build around these stories. You know what I mean? And it starts with just a few believers, and then it grows from there. And, you know, hopefully we'll have opportunity to thank so many of the people that were involved, but I think this is just a unique moment to be able to, you know, say, you know, that you know, Albert Maysles played a part, and that so many people along the way have played a part, and I'm very thankful for that. And right now, it's all about the audience, because I think the audience is playing its part in ways that I dreamed of, and there's still miles yet to travel in his case. He is still incarcerated, and people's voices matter. We've proved that already, but I think we're going to prove it all over again in the next year or so.
Absolutely. All right, folks. We've been talking with Gabriel London, director of the film The Mind of Mark DeVries. And you can catch the film on Showtime on March 19th and on Showtime Demand anytime between March 20th and May 14th. Gabriel, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. Thanks so much for it.
Sure. Appreciate Take it. Care, man. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Gabriel London, the director of the film The Mind of Mark DeVries. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network to talk about police brutality, the recent events in Selma, Alabama, and Madison, Wisconsin, the fight against police murder, and the system behind it. So stay tuned.
Liberation is a must. Ay, 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 ay. Oh, well, now, yeah. Slavery, oh, slavery. We still living in slavery. Slavery, oh, slavery, yeah. Look around, it's still slavery. Slavery won't provide a job. Slavery driving the people mad. Make no for the youths, then why out? Hungry families, yes, to feed hungry families, feed hungry families. They took the chains from off our feet, yet our minds are still bound, yeah. Just like the boundaries in South Africa, they divided and conquered us all.
Welcome back. That's Ross Shiloh with Slavery. And as Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has said, there would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And it's you can find that and other basic truths in the book Basics from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. Joining us now to talk about police brutality, the struggle against it, the struggle against the system behind it, and what's been going on, what are the latest developments there, is Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. It's an intense time, and I know you've been right in the middle of it, and I'm really appreciative of you taking the time to do this interview. We should let people know that you are right now getting ready to speak in St. Louis, Missouri, and it's after a whole weekend of activity and a whole lot of new developments in the scene, actually, that are very important for people to understand. And let's just go through these first. You spent the weekend in Selma, Alabama, as part of the commemoration of the heinous attack by the police and the Klan on black people fighting for voting rights 50 years ago. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? What was it like? What did you learn from it?
Well, look, it was very important that tens of thousands of people flocked to Selma for the 50th anniversary of the heroic resistance that people engaged in 50 years ago to the savage oppression that was being brought down on people. I mean, and people who saw the movie got a taste of that savage oppression, but it really was just a taste in the movie. I mean, it really, and people looking back to that period and upholding that heroic resistance is very important, and it was tens of thousands of people. Like, Selma's a small place, 20,000 people max is its population, but the population of Selma over the weekend was several times as large because of the number of people that came in. And people were looking back, but they were also looking ahead and trying to figure out what do we do now, because while the forms of the oppression aren't the same, there is like savage brutality, murder, and degradation still being brought down on black people. And a lot of people there knew that and wanted to know how to deal with it, and weren't satisfied with what some of the voices had to say. You know, because some of the voices were like, with the Democratic Party, we could take care of this. You know, that was essentially the message of some of the elected officials who spoke, and Reverend Al Sharpton who spoke. And people were dissatisfied with that. They were seeing that, well, look, we've done this. We've done this for decades. We even got a black president, and it's still happening. And people really welcome the fact that there was a whole contingent of people there who brought the message of 50 years ago there was a fight against savage oppression, and today that fight goes on against different forms of savage oppression, and calling on people to get involved in that fight on one level by taking up the call for April 14th as a national shutdown day. People not going to school, not going to work, flocking into the streets, disrupting business as usual to deliver a message that police getting away with murder of black and Latino people in this society must stop. And we went down there with 10,000 palm cards for April 14th and got just about every single palm card out. Hundreds of people gave us their names and contact information because they want to be involved in this. And that ranged from religious groups, college and high school students, and just people who had come to Selma because they wanted to be a part of this historic occasion, but also saw the need to go back home and to mobilize and to organize people to stand up to stop the horrors that were continuing to go down. So I think that was very important. And then a few things, well, one thing that was very little reported, I haven't seen much on it, is one of the original Freedom Riders, Diane Nash, who was invited to be in the front ranks of the march across the bridge, actually refused to march across the bridge because she was asked to march alongside George W. Bush. She said, "This march is about everything that Bush was against, and I'm not marching with him." And that's a pretty heavy statement to make. And look, people have to consider that, okay, Bush does concentrate a lot of the attacks and vicious stuff that's come down on black people. But we also got to grapple with the fact that these attacks have continued under the replacement for George Bush, and that's Barack Obama, the first black president. And it does point to that elections and getting the Democrats into office ain't going to be the way to deal with this. It's going to be people standing up and saying no more, fighting the attacks that are coming down, and doing that as part of fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. And that tied into the other part of the message that we took to people there, which is that this world is a horror, but things don't have to be this way through revolution. We could end all these horrors once and for all, not only the hell that gets brought down on black people, but the attacks on women, the devastation of the environment and all the rest, and that there was a way for people to dig into what revolution is all about, which was by getting ready and in position for the premiere of the film of the dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West that happened last November. Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. And we took 5,000 palm cards about that premiere to Selma. And again, everyone, I mean, at a certain point, we were just completely out of material because people had grabbed up everything that we brought down there to spread.
That's really tremendous, man. That's exciting as hell. Let's move on to one other thing that was, which kind of fits in with everything you've been talking about. On the days before Selma, something else happened out in Madison, Wisconsin. A young black man was savagely gunned down by the police there, and there's been a response to it and a lot of talk about it, especially because it did happen so close to what was being commemorated in Selma. So let's talk about that. You recently wrote a statement on it. I thought it was very powerful. Let's talk about what your thoughts are.
You're talking about the police murder of Tony Robinson up in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's both because it happened right on the eve of the Selma commemoration. It happened on Friday, March 6th, the day before the commemoration was to begin. But the other thing that has pushed it out there nationally has been the response of people in Madison, and especially the young people in Madison, because the day that he was killed, and look, the police got a report of somebody running through traffic and getting in fights, and they show up and break into Tony's house and shoot him, and then drag his body out of the house, leaving his blood stained on the steps that they dragged him down. And people flowed into the streets in anger in the hundreds Friday night, stayed in the streets Saturday and Sunday. But on Sunday, the high school students from the school that Tony had graduated from announced that they were going to walk out of school and protest. And the word spread to other high schools, to middle schools, and to the college there in Madison. And 2,000 people ended up in the streets Monday, marching through the streets of Madison, making their way to the state capitol, and then taking over the state capitol. And most of them were young people, students from middle school up to college, with some older people ringing them to defend them against being attacked by the police. And see, this is very significant because there's been a concerted attempt to suppress the protest movement, to beat it back down, you know, to say, look, you got to stop protesting the police. You're not accomplishing anything. Police have a tough job and you shouldn't be criticizing them like this, you know, all of this kind of stuff, as well as threats and actually hitting back at the protests, mass arrests, putting heavy charges on people. But none of that deterred these young people in Madison. And, you know, I've been telling people, you want to know what April 14th, the National Day of Disrupting Business as Usual in this society, needs to look like? Look at what the young people in Madison are doing. And that needs to be done all across the country. And in fact, I am headed up, because I left Selma, came to St. Louis, as you talked about, and I was going to Chicago, which I'm going to do from St. Louis, but then I'm going to do a detour up into Wisconsin and go to Madison to be out there in the streets with people, speaking to this, you know, calling out and condemning this foul murder, and at the same time bringing to people the way to stand up and say that this must stop and be part of a nationwide movement. Because similar to the way that people in Ferguson sparked this off at the beginning, this action by these students in Madison can give heart to people all around the country and inspire people to get back out into the streets like they were last year, or to come out for the first time.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. All right, Carl, I want to move on to, I know we have to move through this quick, but we've got limited time. I want to move on to another very important thing that's happened over the last few days, and that is the Justice Department findings on Ferguson, on the cop that killed Michael Brown, and on the Ferguson Police Department. What do you got to say about that?
Yeah, see, this is important to look at, because on the one hand, the Justice Department did what it always does, and that is that it exonerated a killer cop. They looked at the murder of Michael Brown by Darren Wilson and said there's no criminal activity here. And they even repeated part of Wilson's story, basically adopting whole hog what the DA in Missouri had done in exonerating Darren Wilson. Then at the same time, they released this report which laid out some of the truth about what the criminal injustice system in Ferguson had been doing to black people for years and years. And I mean, it really was a sickening display of treating people as less than human, because you could just go across the board. Black people were disproportionately stopped by the police. They were disproportionately searched by police when they were stopped. They were disproportionately subjected to arrests and being killed by police. All of the people who were bitten by police dogs were black. And Ferguson, the Ferguson area, was running basically a modern-day debtor's prison, where people would get stopped, get traffic citations written on them, tickets written on them for things they were doing not in the car, fined. And then when they couldn't pay the fines, they would get fined for not paying off the fine. They'd have to pay court fees, and then warrants would be issued. So people would end up in prison because they couldn't pay their debts, with their debts mounting. There was one woman who got two tickets that amounted to $151, and she spent years trying to pay off these tickets. At this point, she has paid over $500, but still owes over $500. And had been arrested several times, which caused her to lose jobs in the midst of trying to do this. And it really took you back to the days of sharecropping and Jim Crow segregation, when the authorities in the southeastern United States would arrest black people for trumped-up charges or even no charges at all, and then hold them as debtors because they would charge them for holding them in jail, and then have them work off the debts. Many of times they would never get them worked off. So this is what we're dealing with. Now, this is a slice of reality, but if you look closely at this report, the Justice Department even says that one of the things the police in Ferguson would do to black people is stop them for walking improperly, jaywalking. Well, that's what Darren Wilson did to Michael Brown. But there's no criminal activity involved. He was violating Michael's rights. as part of a police department that routinely violated the rights of black people, but they could find nothing to bring a civil rights case around. That's one thing that people need to know. They didn't really even believe their own report. But even more importantly, these Department of Justice reports are things that they do on a number of cities. They did one on Los Angeles, they did in Pittsburgh, they did New Orleans, and then they get consent decrees. These cities promise to change the way their police operate and stop them from messing with people. And you just have to ask yourself, has the LAPD stopped brutalizing and murdering black people since they signed a consent decree 15 years ago? Has the New Orleans Police Department stopped brutalizing and murdering black people since they signed a consent decree 7 years ago? And on and on and on, and of course they haven't. So these Department of Justice reports are the system throwing a concession to people to make it appear like they're concerned and trying to do something. But when it comes down to it, nothing will happen, nothing will change. There is not going to be a savior coming from Washington to deal with these problems. And it's like Malcolm X said, you can't go to the federal foxes to get them to do something about what the local wolves are doing to you, because both of them are from the canine family and they equally preside over messing you over. And it's up to the masses of people of all nationalities to stand up and say no more to this. That's what April 14th is all about. And what's needed to get rid of it once and for all is revolution, nothing less. And people who want to get involved in this, who want to deal with this, need to go to the websites revcom.us and stopmassincarceration.net. That's what it, and get involved. Find out what's going on. Dig into where it's coming from. But most important, get involved in doing something about it.
All right, Carl. Now, Carl, I understand you're going to be going on tour around the country in the near future. Is there a way, if people want to have you come to their area, that they can get hold of you and arrange for that?
The way to get in touch with me about coming to your area as part of this tour is to write me at yipzzz@gmail.com or to call me at 917-868-6007.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, look forward to it again. Take care. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with author journalist Larry Everest, and we're going to be talking about the Netanyahu-Obama fistfight, all right? So make sure you tune in for that.
Hey, Mr. Wicked Man, how long shall you live? Robbing up the poor for what is it for sure? The cries of the poor labor your fields, whose money you have now held back by fraud. The cries have now been heard in the ears of the Lord. So with the beef, baff, beef, beef, boom, people shall unite. And with the beef, baff, beef, beef, bang, you are out of sight. And with the
beef... Welcome back. That was Ross Michael with Wicked Man. Joining us now is Larry Everest. Larry is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda, and he's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's going to be here talking with us about the Netanyahu-Obama fistfight. Larry, welcome to the show. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, good to be with you.
Well, let's jump into this right away. You recently wrote an article in Revolution Newspaper, and it was Netanyahu Bites, Obama Snarls Back, When Bloody-Jawed Wolves Feud, Don't Choose Sides, Bring Forward Another Way. And you were talking about the Tuesday, March 3rd feud that erupted between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he addressed the U.S. Congress, and it was at the request of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, and it was specifically to denounce the Obama administration's negotiations with Iran, which are reportedly at a critical point. And Obama quickly went back on TV to sharply and directly counter Netanyahu's charges, arguing that his negotiations were the best way to go to contain Iran and its nuclear program. So these guys were slugging it out. What the hell's going on, Larry?
Well, it's being spun as an argument over war and peace, over how to eliminate the nuclear danger, bring liberation to the Middle East, and so on. And it's nothing of the kind. What's happening right now is that the U.S. imperialists and the Israelis are facing all manner of contradictions in the region. Basically, their whole grip on this area and the structure of power and economic control and domination that they've imposed for decades is under enormous stress, is basically ripping apart at the seams. And this is triggering these stresses and strains are triggering extremely sharp arguments between the U.S. and Israel and within their respective ruling classes over how to maintain their control over this region.
But if they have all these, this stress and strain, I mean, they also still maintain a very special relationship, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, the U.S. has stood by Israel for over 70 years, ever since Israel was formed by the genocide against the indigenous people, the Palestinians. And the reason that they've done this is because dominating this region, which is home to the bulk of, it has been home to the bulk of global petroleum resources. It's a very strategically important geographical and military crossroads, has been a central element of the whole functioning of U.S. imperialism and the U.S. global empire. And for the people of the region, of course, this has just brought one nightmare after another. For decade after decade, the U.S. has supported one military tyrant after another, reactionary fundamentalist regimes like Saudi Arabia, backed Israel in its ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, invaded, done military coups, and on and on and on. I mean, just the history of Iraq is one invasion after another that's led to millions of deaths, including 500,000 children. And Israel has been a key element of this in terms of suppressing the Palestinian population, in terms of waging wars on behalf of the United States in Lebanon, in Gaza, against Jordan, against Syria, helping against Iraq. It's been basically a military outpost in the region. And Israel has not just been a key component for U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. It's crimes and it's dirty work for the empire is extended globally, whether it's supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa or gruesomely helping the U.S. carry out death squad mass murder in Guatemala of 200,000 people, including supplying them with 10,000 Uzis to carry this out. So this is the kind of role that Israel has played for the United States and why this is what this special relationship is about.
All right, well, you've been talking about the special bond, and I guess that's actually what was behind, or maybe I'd ask you this, is that what was behind the fact that both Obama and Netanyahu made special efforts to actually make sure that the world knew that they weren't really at each other's throats in a certain sense? They weren't ready to tear each other to pieces, that they meant no disrespect, but they each had a stand. Is that the situation?
Exactly. No, both in Netanyahu's speech to Congress and when Obama addressed the press, both made exactly that point, that the U.S.-Israeli relationship is stronger in many ways than ever. But at the same time, so why the very intense, these very intense disputes are not, this isn't theater. These are deadly serious arguments between these two predatory powers, precisely because they face unprecedented challenges across the region. Islamic fundamentalisms, groups like ISIS, are growing exponentially. ISIS now controlling large parts of Iraq and Syria. States like Libya, Somalia, Syria, Afghanistan, even Iraq are fragmenting or have basically collapsed. Iran is gaining ground in the region, in Iraq, in Syria, gaining influence in Lebanon. And meanwhile, other global powers like Russia and China are also increasing their influence in the region. And all of this, you know, creates enormous challenges for the U.S. and Israel. How do they continue this ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and strengthening Israel without creating even more outrage around the world and in the region than they have? Is it possible for them to integrate Iran into this horrific structure of U.S. domination? How can they use the Islamic fundamentalists and jihadists in certain situations like Syria, but not let the whole thing get out of control elsewhere? In other words, these are the kind of debates that they're having so fiercely, and they're precisely so fierce because none of their options are very good. They don't have any easy choices at all, and fundamentally, they really have no answers to any of this.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry is an author and journalist. He's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and he's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. You know, it's interesting because it is the point, I guess, that you make in your article that precisely because, you know, that they have this supposedly unbreakable relationship, but that it's precisely because of the intense situation they have that this is such an unprecedented outbreak of argument between the two of them.
That's right. But I think the key thing for people who hate this kind of oppression and the outrageous crimes being carried out by the people against the people of the region is to not take sides with either the Democrats or the Republicans, the Likudniks or other factions in Israel, with either of these reactionary powers, much less see that there's any future whatsoever with these Islamic fundamentalists, whether it be the Iranian version, the Saudi version, the ISIS version, or any of the rest. The people of the world have absolutely no interest in these kind of feuds. The key thing we have to do is see this as a moment when it's really these reactionaries are in deep crisis, facing deep problems. It points to the fact that they're not all powerful, that revolution's possible, and that it's incumbent on us to fight now to bring forward another way, both in terms of resisting the crimes of empire. There's a new five stops poster at revcom.us, and one of the five stops is stop wars of empire, armies of occupation, and crimes against humanity. So opposing, joining with others who are opposing these kinds of crimes, opposing the real machinations and what these rulers are doing, exposing their lies about going to the Middle East to try to bring peace, to liberate the people, to protect against terror, and resist all of these outrages by the U.S. government. At the same time, I think it's very important for people to realize and work for the real possibility of an opening for an actual revolution in this country. I'd recommend people read this new piece by Bob Avakian that's been posted at RevCom, What is a Revolutionary Situation? And he describes a deep crisis, sharpening conflicts in society and in the government where the rulers can't find a way to resolve the conflicts. And what they do further undermines them. I mean, people should read the whole thing. And I think this is the kind of a situation we're in. And no one can really say how far this contradiction in relation to other contradictions, including the very important and heroic struggle people are waging here against police murder, can go. But the key thing is we've got to seize on this to fight for a whole other world when there aren't these kinds of predatory settler colonial states and imperialist powers. Don't have power anymore, aren't in existence anymore, and to fight for a whole different kind of future, a completely different future for humanity.
Well, let me ask you one final question, Larry, and it's at the end of your article, and it was kind of intriguing. You do say, and you've been speaking to this a little, but I wonder if you can expand on it a little. You say that these challenges, opposing the crimes of the U.S. and Israel and getting to a world free of all oppression, are in fact tightly integrated, that basically it has a certain impact on what people do and think these days, right?
Well, I think it really does. If people could really understand the truth about what the U.S. and Israel are all about and what they do to the people in the world, to see through the lies of a movie like American Sniper, which we recently wrote about at RevCom, and to understand how these regimes are the worst savages on the face of the earth, the most unrepentant for savagery and mass murder. They have no rivals on earth, and their power is totally illegitimate. And this can have a huge impact on how people see everything they do, whether it be the treatment of women in this country, whether it be the treatment of immigrants, how the police operate in this country, and the whole function of this state. And that's a, you know, that's a key part of building a movement and strengthening a movement for revolution that can bring a radically different kind of future, is when people begin to see the actual truth about the nature of this country and what it does around the world.
All right, Larry Evers, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Michael.
All right, take care, man. All right, we've just been talking with Larry Evers, the writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And if you want to read more of Larry's articles, his analysis of what's going on in the Middle East, go to revcom.us and you can find it all there, all right? All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, filmmaker Gabriel London, Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Larry Evers, author and writer for Revolution Newspaper. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Ross Michael and Wicked Man. Talk to you again next week.
Just must stand. So with the beef, paf, a beef, beef, boom, the people shall unite. And with the beef, paf, a beef, beef, bang, you are out of sight. And with the beef, paf, a beef, beef, poof, you have done the wrong. And with the beef, paf, a beef, beef, boom, you have done the wrong. So, hey, Mr. Wicked Man, how long shall you robbing up the poor for what is for sure.